Hi and welcome to episode 0 of Attention Please podcast, our brand new podcast here on the Talking Stuff Network. We are recording this on 28th July India time. If the name of the podcast is not a dead giveaway, let me tell you who your host is. For starters, he is not the guy screaming at the top of his lungs at the nation and his guests every evening. But he is the straight-shooting, Bollywood-loving, politically incorrect founder of the Cult of Gunda, the author of several books including The Mine, Sultan of Delhi, Yatrik, Mahabharata Murders, and of course, may I have your attention please? You know him as Great Bong, Arnab Ray. Hi Arnab, you have my full attention please.
Thank you, Vikram. Great to be here. So, for everybody, this is the Attention Please Scott podcast, the first episode. Hopefully, we will have more, but this could be the end, for all you know. So, the idea behind a podcast, why would I want to do a podcast after having blogged since 2005? So, the blog isn't going away, but for those of you who follow the blog, you realize that I don't blog as much as I used to. And that's partially a function of my lack of time, but also because I feel that people just don't read anymore. I hope people hear, because when we started out the blog, when I started the blog in 2004, you know, bandwidth was expensive, and whatever bandwidth that you had, obviously you used it to watch porn like everybody else. But I mean, why exactly? The internet exists for porn, of course. But then now we are in 2018, and I would hope that you have some spare bandwidth left for podcasts and for, content. So hoping that to be the case, I thought, why not start a podcast and see where that leads us? So here it is. What to expect? I really have no idea. I have a kind of a format. I'm going to talk about different things. Hopefully in future podcasts, we will have guests. Hopefully they'll be famous, or maybe this podcast will make them famous. Whatever it is, I will be experimenting a little bit. I'm 42. So at 42, when somebody says somebody's experimenting, that means they're going to do a podcast. That's really it. So this is my version of experimenting at 42. So let's take it from here. Let's see where this goes.
Happy to be the vehicle for your midlife crisis, Arnab, if this turns out well. It's been an exciting week to launch this podcast. We have loads of news, Star Kids being launched, Imran Khan's erections and election, Trump always occupies bandwidth, Modi versus Rahul at the no confidence motion. With so much going on, what caught your attention the most?
What caught my attention the most? The thing that caught my attention the most was the hashtag talk to a Muslim. I think I'm a little bit late on that, because I think, you know, hashtags, they die away. So I think I'm kind of catching it at the trail of its death. But Talk to a Muslim will come back in a different way. I mean, it's the latest incarnation of the intolerance narrative. So it'll come back in some other way, but it is worth talking about. So when I first saw Talk to a Muslim, I was genuinely surprised. What exactly does that mean? Like, talk to any Muslim? Well, then I would like to talk to Katrina Kaif. And I'm absolutely sure that there will be a line extending from Kashmir to Kanyakumari, people who want to talk to Katrina Kaif. And here's a question. Who would be at the end of the line? And the answer is Rahul Gandhi, because he said, I'm always standing with the person at the end of the line. So, of course, it's not a problem to talk to a particular Muslim. There are a lot of very, very popular Muslims who people would be giving their right arm to talk to. I get what the hashtag is about, of course. I kind of think that, you know, it kind of got mixed reactions. There were a lot of people who felt, you know, why do you have to talk to me? I don't want to talk to you. And I think that is a valid reaction. I mean, why would you want to, or the point perhaps is that before 2014, everybody talked to Muslims, and suddenly after 2014, nobody talks to Muslims. Or people who used to talk to people suddenly realized, hey, my best friend is Muslim. Maybe that's the point. And I don't think that's really the point, nor do I think that's true. I don't think that particularly anything has happened in terms of our interactions with anybody else. It's true that social media has definitely ruined a lot of friendships, but that has got nothing to do with religion. That has got everything to do with opinion. And I'm absolutely convinced about the pernicious nature of social media in that sense that, you know, if people you've known for, you know, 20 years, you suddenly realize what a douchebag they are once you start getting their WhatsApp forward. So I get that. But again, it's not something which is religious. It's more like behavior. Now, different kinds of behavior are coming to the fore, which you did not see before. And that's a worthwhile conversation having, and maybe we'll discuss that some other day.
So who comes up with these things? Is there a meeting room somewhere with smug MBAs and a whiteboard with a bunch of ideas like award vapsi or intolerance, not in my name, talk to a Muslim and all written on it?
Again, I really don't know. I can only speculate. I think they come from the different IT cells that I think all parties nowadays have. Whenever people say IT cell, people think BJP, and BJP definitely had the first mover's advantage. I mean, they basically took a lead for about 3 years, I would say, on the Congress, definitely 2 years on the AAP. And so the word IT cell automatically brings up a picture of, you know, Amit Shah sitting in a classroom and like hundreds of zombies, you know, typing out automated tweets. But everybody has it. And I'd made a point, you know, a few days ago that the reason why the Congress never thought of social media is because they already had their own media, which they've had since independence. So they never really realized that there was an alternate media that they needed to tap into. It really happens to many companies where they have been following the same business model for decades, and then the disruptor comes up and then they realize, oh my goodness, we have to catch up now. So this is, you know, pretty standard. Coming back to your question, you know, who came up with talk to a Muslim? I really don't know. It's possibly some PR agency, some political party, IT cell. I don't think these things just suddenly organically spring up, because they just don't. In order for something to trend, in order for some people to actually talk about it, it's rarely organic, unless it's something like, you know, Priyanka Chopra getting married. Okay, that is absolutely organic, and that's very important, of course. But something like this, it's manufactured, and you automatically, and this works for both sides. I mean, Times Now and Republic TV, which is another alternate form of reality now, they have made their own world is basically driven by hashtags. So Tukre Tukre Gang. Of course, nobody came up with Tukre Tukre. I mean, this is not an organic thing, right? Tukre Tukre Gang is definitely as made up as Talk to a Muslim. And they're both equally ridiculous, by the way. But Talk to a Muslim, I think there is a larger point, which is interesting and which actually, you know, deserves to be talked about. And that's the notion of otherization. So I was watching a program on NDTV. So they were going on about otherization. So for those of you who don't know what otherization means, and it looks fairly self-evident.
And also to those of you who don't know what NDTV is.
Yeah, I haven't watched it for years. It's still there, by the way. So otherization basically means that that a community is locked into its own identity, that we tend to see of communities as not belonging to us. So that's where the otherization comes along. It's not necessarily violence, or it's just that we don't think of themselves as being ours. So here's what I feel about otherization. So while the larger point of lynching and communal violence, I'm keeping that aside, that there's a point of violence and of not following the law. But if you look at otherization, I would say that, so there are two models of what a nation should be. So there is the one of assimilation, where people don't have any identity other than the national identity. Now, our social justice warriors have told us that this is basically majoritarianism by another name. Because ultimately, the assimilation into what? Assimilation into the culture and the community of the majority community. So what's important is for everybody to be able to choose their own identity, to maintain their diversity. So unity in diversity, that is the Indian model. It's not assimilation. So, okay, point taken. But there is a flip side to that. If you maintain your identity, you are otherizing yourself. And that's a good thing. So you are otherizing yourself by asserting your identity. Let's take a very simple example, my own example. I have been in the US since 1999. I have consistently otherized myself by not following American football, not having Super Bowl parties. I just don't like American football. I don't like basketball. But then I can't claim that I'm being otherized if I'm not called to a Super Bowl party, because I've chosen that myself. I have chosen to otherize myself from Americans by not following their sports. The only sport I follow is cricket. So I would be offended if people said, no, in order to be a good American, by the way, I'm not an American, I'm an Indian passport, but I've been staying here since 99. In order to respect your host country, you should, you know, follow their sports. I would not like that, because I would say that, you know, that's forced assimilation. So otherization, again, I talked to a Muslim, it was a lot about otherization. Otherization is not necessarily a bad thing. I think we should all be otherized and not be forcibly assimilated.
Arnab, you have the various ethnic groups, right, in the US. You have the Irish who have assimilated at the same time, maintained their cultural identity, and various other ethnicities who have managed to straddle both their identities, like Ajay Devgan standing on two bikes.
Yeah, exactly. And it's possible. It's possible, and I think it's needed. And if the Irish person thinks that they're being otherized, well, they want to be otherized. Now, I understand that we're talking about a negative sense of otherization in this case. And my opinion is that India has always been a divided society. There's no two ways about it. Whatever prejudice we have prejudices like any other country. It doesn't do us any good to deny that it exists, or it doesn't do us any good to say that we shouldn't do anything about it. I'm not saying that. I also understand the notion of, you know, me being a, you know, a Hindu male. And so there are lots of things which I don't perceive. And just because I don't perceive them doesn't necessarily mean they don't exist. I totally understand that also. But that part I understand, that we need to do a lot more as a nation. Yeah, definitely. But what I don't agree is that everything was okay before 2014 and things have gone to the dogs. That is a political viewpoint which is not backed up by data. Nor is it backed up by reality. Absolutely. Because I have seen, so we're talking about lynchings nowadays. I grew up in an extremely sheltered family in Calcutta, extremely sheltered. I didn't go anywhere without my parents accompanying me. And so, and also I didn't go around a lot of places. But even in my sheltered urban Calcutta existence, I have seen two lynchings directly. I've seen two thieves being beaten up, I'm pretty sure to death. I didn't see them die, but they were pretty close. So, I grew up in a genteel Calcutta. Calcutta is not the wild, wild west. So I've seen that in the 80s. Once my father, we were traveling in a train. He protested against smugglers who were smuggling rice. He got lynched, almost got lynched in front of me and my mother by those rice smugglers. And then the railway police came in, and they were in cahoots with the rice smugglers. They dragged my father, almost holding him by the collar, to the holding place, and they were going to throw him into jail and for disrupting them from doing their job, by the way. And the only thing that saved my dad was he was a professor at Indian Institute of Management, Calcutta. And the officer in charge, he basically took my father and my mother and me away from them. And then he crossed the bridge. This was in Baligan Station. He crossed the bridge. He escorted us. And then once he was at the other end of the bridge, he did, I'm so sorry, sir. There's nothing I can do. These people are out of control. There's nothing I can do. I mean, he was literally in tears. So what I'm trying to say is that I've seen lynchings. I've almost seen my own dad getting lynched. There was a time, and I don't remember this personally, but about a mile or so from where I stayed, a bunch of, there was a Hindu Hindu monastic order called Anandamargis. So there were a few of them who were lynched to death on the suspicion that they were kidnapping children. Sounds familiar? Yeah, this happened in the 1980s. And at that point of time, this wasn't really big news. I mean, when I tell people, they were like, we never heard this outside Calcutta. Calcutta, it was big news. But at this point of time, nobody was trying to push a narrative that there were lynchings going on. This was considered to be the background noise of staying in India. And I'm not saying that's acceptable. I'm not saying we should accept any lynchings. I don't think we should accept any. But all the data that's currently being kept is being kept after 2014. Before, there are two things. Either it never happened or we were absolutely fine with it. So that's where I really, you know, that's where my issue is more than anything else.
What struck me was that you had to explicitly say that you're not pro-lynching, right? I mean, that's the politically correct times we live in, that one has to explicitly say that, hey, I'm not for lynching. I'm just making a point here.
Yeah, yes, because over here nowadays, if you try to push anything which is counter to the narrative that you see on NDTV, which again, I don't think is the most popular narrative, but it is definitely one of the more influential narratives. NDTV having given its viewership, the amount of influence it exerts is vastly disproportionate to its popularity. I have to explicitly say that, look, I'm not in support of lynchings. Lynchings are a bad thing for whatever reason it is. You cannot take the law into your hands. You cannot have violence. But the fact is, and you are doing it, you're doing yourself a disservice. I'm absolutely for having a lynching law. If the current law is unable to deal with this problem, you can have a very specific targeted law. That's fine. I'm also not saying that just because we did not deal with this before, we are kind of obligated to never deal with it in the future. Of course, we evolve. Of course, we have to change. That's also true. But to have this selective memory that everything was fine before 2014 and suddenly everything has become bad, this is not just only bad politics. This is actually what prevents you from solving the problem. Because if tomorrow, let's say Rahul Gandhi comes into power, let's say, I'm not saying he's going to, but let's say Mamata Banerjee becomes the prime minister or Rahul Gandhi becomes the prime minister, which again, I don't honestly think will happen, but it could, it's not beyond the realms of possibility, then you would find that these problems have suddenly gone away. It's not because the problems will have gone away. The problems will stay. People will still die. So, but the news attention will go from this to, I'm guessing, Priyanka Chopra's first child at that point.
Yeah, the parda will be drawn on the lynchings.
We will now move on. Maybe we'll go to corruption because, people will, Congress corruption, it's not that people will try to cover that up. People, even NDTV will not cover that up, but they will cover this part of it. It's not a question of cover. It's as Rajdeep Sardesai says, tyranny of distance and moral compass. So it'll just be that, Bengal is not in Delhi, so we couldn't cover it. So there'll be some excuse. It's not that they will say that it's not happening, but, we have to prioritize news. So that's what they'll say.
I'm glad you brought up the other very important burning topic now. Priyanka Chopra getting engaged.
Yes, I have absolutely no idea who this Nick Jonas guy is. I mean, I presume he's some famous American, because even in America, I mean, I hang out with the wrong crowd, but even in America, I don't know who he is. So I guess he must be somebody famous. I'm really happy for Priyanka Chopra, but I'm a little disappointed that the Indian media is not giving it a Taimur Khan-like coverage, because I think this requires wall-to-wall coverage. I am kind of disappointed there hasn't been that amount of, it's still that Taimur Khan is getting more coverage than Priyanka Chopra and also Sachin Tendulkar's son. So these things have to change. I want to hear what is the significance of this relationship to Indo-American relations. And what does this mean? Is this the first Indian star who has truly crossed over to the US? I want to understand the cultural significance of what's going on. And I also understand that Salman Khan is extremely angry that she walked out on a film appropriately titled Bharat. So whenever you look at it, Priyanka Chopra walks out of Bharat. So it's doubly ironic. And if Salman Khan is angry, I wouldn't want to be sleeping on the pavement in Bombay at this point of time.
Tell me something. Why are only our women able to cross over across the borders? I mean, I know the ship has sailed for you and I, but why only Priyanka Chopra or Sania Mirza? Why not Salman Khan?
Salman Khan is the only export quality man we have. I don't think there's anybody who's eligible. And nobody's single, and Salman Khan is also, it's not just single. According to himself, he's a virgin also. So, which also means he doesn't. Not only is his car self-driven, but other than Bin, I can't think of anybody who can do that. But Salman Khan, yeah, Salman Khan can definitely do a Priyanka Chopra. It might be getting it a little bit. He might be leaving it a little bit late, but you never know. Salman Khan, you never know.
I have to now Google this Nick Jonas and find out if he has a sister. Then we can probably have a hum up kind of a scenario, maybe.
So moving on, I think we should talk about the no confidence vote. I found that was extremely, extremely amusing. I don't know whose idea it was to have a no confidence vote.
Chandrababu Naidu.
It was Chandrababu Naidu's, yes, of course. And now I severely doubt the acumen of Chandrababu Naidu. I always had this impression that he was this super smart guy. But why would you, the BJP is having a fairly rough few months. I would say it's had a rough year. Why would you want to give it the optics of overwhelmingly destroying the opposition in anything with numbers? Why would you even want to do that? Because a no confidence motion is basically harking back to BJP's strongest year. Because that's when these numbers were basically frozen. So if people have forgotten, right, how decisive their victory was. You just reminded everyone how decisive their victory was. And the fact that they have like a plus 199 advantage over everybody else, even after the seats that they have lost. So in terms of why they would want to do it, it is beyond me. The biggest thing was, of course, Rahul Gandhi's hug. So that was... And I read a lot of articles. Of course, of course, Rahul Gandhi arrived again. He's arrived again and again and again and again. I think he will always keep on arriving. I don't use the word come here. Arrived. He arrived again. But this hug, which I found was, everybody said what a great gesture it was. It was a shallow gesture, but he totally took the moment from Modi. He could have if he hadn't done the wink after that. So the hug definitely caught Modi by surprise. As a move, first of all, this was a good moment for Rahul Gandhi. Rahul Gandhi has been having a fairly good last few months in the sense that and for Rahul Gandhi, of course, the bar is very low of what his success is. As long as he can tie his shoelaces and he can sit and he can drink from his sippy cup, we consider that a good month for Rahul Gandhi. And he's definitely elevated himself. He doesn't have that look of I wish I was anywhere else other than politics. So he looks engaged. His social media account is being run much better. So he's getting that done. I still don't think that he is at a stage where he can be an effective prime minister. But again, the bar is really low for him. So given that the bar is low for him, I think the hug was okay. But then what he did was he goes back to his seat and he gives this superior smirking wink, which totally shows that this was a performance. And it was like, the jock in class saying, kya diya, kya? So the problem with Rahul Gandhi is that, and it's kind of unfair to him, is that whenever he is in a one-on-one situation with Modi, Rahul Gandhi represents the worst of India in a way. And some of it is not even his fault. So he represents the ultimate Baba Log. he represents the ultimate, you know, classist, feudal, old royalty. I mean, he is royalty essentially. And he is against the person he's and against. Modi plays it up himself, that whole Chaiwala thing. But, you know, it is true that Modi is exactly the anti-Rahul. This is a guy who's self-made, who doesn't have rich parents, who has a humble background, who has come up here without the backing of anybody really strong. And this is the story that the Indian youth today want for themselves. Okay, most of us are not born like Rahul Gandhi. Most of us are born more like Modi than like Rahul Gandhi. So that is, whenever Rahul Gandhi goes in a room, more people will find their stories match with Modi's rather than with Rahul Gandhi's. That is Rahul Gandhi's biggest problem. Because ultimately, when we vote for someone, when it's how closely do we like that person? You know, how closely does this story resembles mine? And when Rahul Gandhi does that kind of, you know, winking, that it just consolidates that image of this prince, this extremely superior, smirky, prep school kind of guy who's doing this, but who's well aware of the irony, who's well aware of the insincerity of his gesture. And that, I believe, I mean, I'm absolutely sure he is insincere as any other politician. I don't expect sincerity from politicians. But to telegraph that insincerity like that.
I was imagining that his babysitters or handlers or whoever, whatever you want to call them, they must probably be high-fiving themselves the moment he kind of pulled off the hug. And then, you know, they were probably slapping themselves in the forehead moment he gave that wink. Saying, you know, yaar, fir dubadiya.
Yes, so I think that first part was rehearsed and somebody told him to do it. The second part was himself. And that's where I believe he screwed up. Of course, his Darbari media people, of course, played it up as an enormously successful gesture. But I would draw issue with that. I think it was not. I think in the last 6 months, the Modi government has had a bad time. That was their best day in the last 6 months. And there was no good reason why they should have had that day.
You've not listened to the latest Dhruv Rathi in that case, because he has exactly opposite opinion of yours, that Rahul probably...
I don't really follow Dhruv Rathi. I mean, I know he's a very influential on video. Yeah, he's followed by Kejriwal, or Kejriwal retweets him. And of course, I totally respect Dhruv Rathi's opinions. But I would say respectfully that my take is somewhat different than his on this issue. Let me just put it this way: the likelihood that Dhruv Rathi and I will ever see the same thing is really low. I think we're on opposite sides. But I've seen some of his earlier work, and then they're pretty good. I mean, he talks well, and he puts in some facts. I think he's very good at what he does, and I think he's been rather properly rewarded for that. He's extremely influential, and maybe one of the reasons why I'm doing this podcast is because I want to be Dhruv Rathi, you know, as best as I can.
So, Mr. Dhruv Rathi, if you're listening to this, we would love to have you as a guest here on Attention Please podcast.
Absolutely. So, moving on, what should we do now? We have Imran Khan. I haven't talked about Imran Khan. I have so many things to say. Yeah. So, as you may have known, I actually paid money, $10, to buy Rehim Khan, the unofficial and the perhaps the most unofficial biography of anybody ever written. That book, my goodness, is just an explosion of the Faisalabad pitch. It's like on the fifth day when the ball hits the Faisalabad pitch and it just bursts. And you know, fragments of earth come and fly at you from different places. That's how that book is. I mean, I reviewed it on my blog. I don't want to spoil it. I don't want to spoil it because the last thing I would ever want to happen is for Rehim Khan to lose even a dollar of her revenue. That would be disastrous. I mean, somebody who wrote this deserves to make $1 billion. So I wish her the best. I wish her great sales. And I strongly recommend that all of you buy this, especially if those of us, those of you like me who grew up in the 80s idolizing Imran Khan and also being extremely jealous of Pakistan for having like Imran Khan and Wasim Akram while we had Doda Ganesh on the other end. So for us, this is almost like some kind of vicarious pleasure to read about Imran Khan as he actually is. Though he's the prime minister and we really do know a lot about him after reading this book. And none, I think, more entertaining than, and that's the only thing that I can talk about, is he has an obsession for black lentils, which is absolutely hilarious. I mean, the way it comes up in this book is just brilliant. And it's hilarious because, you see, the cornerstone of good humor is that it's unexpected. You laugh the most when something is not what you expect. It's a way of breaking tension. And, you know, this whole idea of Imran Khan, you know, lathering his privates with a black men, it's just so unexpected. It's just something which you could have expected some other things. You could have expected some other debaucheries, which are more predictable. But this was absolutely came from left field. It's like you're facing Abdul Qadir and suddenly he gives his bouncer and breaks your nose. It's like that. This book, and I've forgotten what the name of the book is, but when I was young, I actually bought the official autobiography of Imran Khan. I mean, I've been obsessed with Imran Khan ever since I saw him, you know, Gundappa Vishwanath. You couldn't even see, he was on the fag end of his career at this point of time. And I remember he lifted his bat. He thought the ball was going to swing out. It just boomeranged in and took his stump. And I think that was the last time he played. So I've seen him. That was the first series I ever saw. So I've always been fascinated by Imran Khan. And he's always has this aura of being a winner. Right? He was a great bowler, but he was nowhere close to Wasim Akram, I would say. As an all-rounder, also as a batsman, I think he was an all-rounder, true, but he wasn't great as a batsman either. But the one thing about Imran Khan was he always knew how to win. And we at that point of time, we absolutely knew only how to lose. So the contrast between a team which could get defeat from the most unlikeliest situation and Imran Khan, we knew he would win at the end. So he's always been this person who's been born to win, even with the 92 World Cup. If you remember the 92 World Cup, he had a really bad 92 World Cup. In the game, they were going to be eliminated against New Zealand. He played an ultra slow innings. And they were only saved by Inzamamul Haq and Moin Khan at the end. Nobody knew who Inzamamul Haq at that point of time was. So he was thin. He came out and he just belted the attack all over the place. It was a great innings. But again, many people perhaps don't even remember the Inzamam innings, but they do remember Imran Khan. And this whole series then became about him. And that's the last time I saw him, I think, 92. I don't know if he played after that. But now he's prime minister again. And I always wonder and I'm amazed at, you know, how some people can consistently keep on winning. I think that there's something to, it can't just be luck. And, you know, it doesn't matter if, you know, there's the army is behind him, he's a puppet. Every democratic prime minister in Pakistan has been a puppet. I mean, who hasn't been a puppet? The moment you stop being a puppet, you land up in jail like Bhutto Senior. So that is a given. Imran Khan is a puppet for those Indians who feel that this will mark a new era in Indo-Pakistan relationship. There's a bridge I have to sell you. It's not going to happen because this is a paradox of Pakistan-India relationship, is that our relationship with Pakistan is the best when they have a dictator. It has always been the case. We didn't fight when Zia-ul-Haq was their president. The genocide of Kashmiri Pandit started right after Benazir Bhutto became the prime minister. So, bad things happen when there is democracy. And that's always been the case because with democracy, they need something to take people's attention away. And there is nothing better than India. So there's always been a heightening of tensions. Kargil happened under Nawaz Sharif, okay? Once Musharraf became, you know, it became better. Okay, it became, I wouldn't say it became great, but it became better. We were at least playing cricket and everything at that point of time. So I have no hopes from Imran Khan. I'm absolutely, but as I tweeted, you know, there's some concern that Imran Khan is, you know, he has very strong views on blasphemy. He's endorsed death for blasphemers. He's allied himself with public elements of the Taliban. And for me, I'm not worried about that because everything that comes out of Imran Khan's mouth is a lie. So obviously, he's not going to do any of that. He's just there to, you know, be the prime minister. So I'm not overtly concerned about that Imran Khan personally is an Islamist. I don't think he is. But he'll say anything to get elected. And he's done that. And he'll do anything to stay in power. So if that means ratcheting up tension against India, he's going to do it. I have no doubt that he will.
At the risk of sounding frivolous, I think my biggest worry is, will Imran Khan be entertaining?
Well, that's a valid point. Imran Khan's become boring. I mean, even when he does commentary, it's extremely boring. I mean,
exactly.
His commentary is so sleep inducing. I mean, he just doesn't have. First of all, he has this fake macho voice and that clipped British accent. I prefer Javed Miazad's voice any day over his. And he's not extremely insightful either. I remember he used to do commentary in Sharjah. He was also doing commentary in that 96 game also against India. So Wasim Akram is by far the best Pakistani commentator there is, in the sense that Wasim Akram understands the game. If you listen to him, he's not like Ravi Shastri. So Shahzan was, one guy is the idiot. And the other guy is really, really good in terms of understanding the game. Ravi Shastri understands nothing, of course. But Wasim Akram, he understands. He really understands the game. He's one of the, I mean, I would say if I, among cricket intellectuals, I would rank him as the number one cricket intellectual there is today. I would rank Jeff Boycott there too, but you know he doesn't do commentary anymore. So, yeah, I hold him in really high esteem in terms of his knowledge. But Imran Khan, I have never seen anything insightful ever that he said in terms of his cricket commentary. Can't recollect. And he's very boring. He's very boring in general.
So I hope Imran Khan makes Pakistan great again.
I sincerely hope, and I hope that he buries the hatchet with his ex-wife and gives her the position that she so wants. I mean, that book is just her auditioning to be a politician on the party which is against Imran Khan. So it's just one huge audition. And I hope that book is worth much more than $10. My advice to Rehan Khan is, you're undervaluing your book. Okay, that's a $100 book, straight up.
So before we wrap up this episode, a quick prediction. What are the chances that we'll see her in maybe a future episode of Big Boss?
I don't think, she's not, if I understand Rehan Khan, you will see her as a prime minister, I'm telling you. If she plays her cards right, I mean, there is a chance that someday she will become the prime minister. I mean, Big Boss is for Raki Sawant and for Ayaz Khan. She is going somewhere. I mean, that book, it isn't, I mean, I'm kind of trivializing it, but that book's actually well written. It's not just about Imran Khan, but in terms of the political picture she paints. I mean, there's a pretty salacious section on General Musharraf also there. So, I mean, that book is actually, I mean, nobody in India writes a book like that. Even if you read our journalist books, or, you know, I haven't read what Karan Thapar has written, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be nowhere close to, you know, that book. And I'm not even talking about Imran Khan. I'm talking about, in general, about the insights you get into the way Pakistan politics works. So I think it's a genuinely good book. Even if you get past the more salacious bits, there's also like really, really good material about Pakistani politics that's in the book.
So you heard it here first, folks. Rehan Khan might just be the future Prime Minister of Pakistan, inshallah.
Yeah, so that it'll She has a time. So it's not going to mean Imran Khan, man. He had to wait from 92, his highest point in life, to 2018 to become the prime minister. So look at the, you know, the lead time you need.
But she's lost her chance to be the Rabri Devi of Pakistan, right?
Then that's not going to happen. I mean, Pakistan is a different thing. We cannot use the metaphors of India to Pakistan. I mean, it's a very different country with a very different political culture, very interesting political culture. It's sad that we have been fighting. I genuinely enjoy Pakistani cricket and Pakistani politics. I mean, they're second to none, really.
Here's something you probably didn't know. When Benazir Bhutto, she was campaigning, she had these songs in the campaign, and to this day they are so popular in Hyderabad. So when you have like a bunch of drunk guys, one of them is going to say, "Arey, Bhutto gaane laga." Those songs play even now in all.
Yeah, I think Hawa Hawa, that song is originally, if I'm not wrong, is originally a PPP song.
A lot of 90s Bollywood, in fact, was strictly lifted from Benazir Bhutto campaign songs.
Yes, so I think Hawa Hawa is one of them. There was this song, G-A-G-A-G-A Benazir, and that became
exactly,
a song in Amitabh Bachchan's Akela, Tu Hai Meri Dil Ki Rani. Yeah, so
I forgot who I was talking to. Of course, of course, none of this is a surprise to you.
So no. Yeah, I know that a lot of those songs became "Jiye Jiye Jiye Benazir" was definitely became a Hindi song. You know, many years after that. Na maina jhoota bolu.
Exactly.
That song.
So I guess kind of wraps up this first episode of Attention Please podcast.
Yep, it does. I think that was a lot of fun. I hope you'll have a lot of fun editing. great.
Of course, I assume that listeners here know how to reach you, but do you want to give a shout out on where all they can find you?
Sure. So my blog is at greatbong.net. My Twitter handle is @greatbong. And if you want to email, it's greatbong@gmail.com. And I hope you join us for our next podcast, should that podcast exist.
So whether or not this podcast continues is entirely up to you, my dear listeners. So if you enjoyed it, please let us know. You can mail us at appodcast, that's attentionpleasepodcast@talkingstuff.net, or tweet to us at @talkingstuffnet. Our website is, as you would have guessed, talkingstuff.net. Tell us why you liked it or why you didn't, and also what else you would like to hear Arnab talk about. You can subscribe to this podcast on any podcast player of your choice on either iOS or Android, or even listen to it on talkingstuff.net and of course at greatbong.net. So see you in the next episode, hopefully. Bye.